I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The two presidential candidates debate foreign policy tonight. We'll have a debate preview in a moment. But first, at least three bombs exploded near a U.S. convoy in western Baghdad today, killing 35 children and three adults. Hours earlier, a suicide car bombing killed an American soldier and two Iraqis on the outskirts of the city. Also today, the Arab news network Al Jazeera is showing a video of 10 new hostages seized by militants. Howard LaFranchi is in Iraq for the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us from Baghdad. Howard, what can you tell us about today's attacks?
Well, as you know, days can be pretty brutal in Baghdad, but today was particularly sad, as you noted. 42 people were killed at that series of bombings that seemed to be targeted at a U.S. convoy, but of the 42, 35 were children. Seems what happened is that the convoy was guarding a ceremony that was taking place dedicating a neighborhood sewage system that was coming online. And so there were people from the neighborhood in the area. One bomb went off. Another convoy or other U.S. Vehicles rushed to come to the assistance of the other convoys that were attacked in the first bomb. And when the other vehicles arrived, two more bombs were set off, and this sent metal and other objects flying and cut down, as I said, 42 people killed, among them 35 children, but a large number of injured as well.
And we also hear that there are 10 new hostages that have been taken, some Iraqis. Who are the others? Do you know?
No, I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't have much more information on that. That was a recent bit of news, and I don't really know much more
about
that.
That's all right. Have you heard anything more about the British hostage?
No, the British hostage seems to be a really very a gruesome case of stretching things out. The terrorists in that case seeming to be playing on the fact that the Labor Party conference is going on in the moment and doing their best to put Tony Blair in the hot seat. As you know, Prime Minister Blair did come out with a statement that if the terrorists in that case, if the kidnappers got in touch with the British government, that they would respond immediately. It was a little bit unclear what he meant by that, if they just meant a verbal response or would actually try to respond to the kidnappers' demands.
Which would raise a lot of questions about negotiating. Howard, we've run out of time. As you say, it does raise questions about what their policy would be on negotiating, and hopefully we'll hear more on that. Howard, thank you. That's our delay to Baghdad. Howard LaFranchi covers Iraq for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from Baghdad. Well, Iraq will top the agenda tonight at 9 p.m. in the first of three presidential debates. The focus is foreign policy and security. Analysts say President Bush will need to defend his preemptive war in Iraq without seeming bullheaded, while Senator Kerry must convince voters that he can enlist the aid of more allies in Iraq and be a strong leader without being a flip-flopper. But almost as important as the message is how it's delivered. Joining us to talk about the candidates as debaters are two journalists who have seen them in action, Joan Bernanke of the Boston Globe and Wayne Slater of the Dallas Morning News. And Wayne, let's start with you. Back in 1994, when Mr. Bush was running for governor of Texas against a popular incumbent, Ann Richards, you were on the panel for their only debate. And we've heard quite a bit about how the expectations were so high that Ann Richards was going to win the debate hands down.
Oh, absolutely, and that's what we were hearing in the press. You talk to the Bush people, and they were saying, oh, my gosh, he can barely talk, and Richards is this great orator. She'll blow us out of the water. So the expectations for him were almost zero. He certainly met those, and in fact, I just watched again the 94 debates, and I think he won that debate.
Well, in fact, I don't know if either of you read James Fallow's terrific article in The Atlantic in July, but he also went back and watched the tapes and said that this was a George Bush unlike the George Bush we see today.
You know, one of the things that Fallows did not do was look back seriously at 1978. That was the first political debate that George Bush ever had. Mm-hmm. He ran for Congress. He lost. And in that race, he was portrayed as an elitist Ivy Leaguer who could not stay on message. He actually is the John Kerry character back in 78. He lost that race. He told the guy who beat him, Congressman Ken Hance, that he will never, ever, ever let that happen again. He would stay on message. He would absolutely establish who he is. He would never be portrayed or allow someone else to portray who he is as a candidate. And he really never has.
It's so interesting, Joe, and I'm sure you're hearing that as well, that Wayne says that in that race, George Bush was positioned as the John Kerry type. In other words, the elite candidate. You followed John Kerry for years here in Boston. Let's ask you about Kerry's debate performance during his Senate race in 1996 against then-Governor William Weld. How was it thought that John Kerry fared?
What's amazing is how much the situation now mirrors what he faced in 1996. At the time of the debates, it was right after Labor Day, only 35% of the people thought that he should be reelected, and only 31% found him likable. And likability is kind of an issue right now, as I understand it.
Against a very likable governor who did things like dive into the river when he was announcing a new clean water project.
Right. Weld went into these debates with a lot of goodwill behind him. He'd just been reelected with a huge margin, and people liked him. They came to these debates at Faneuil Hall. The setting was very solemn and dignified and steeped in history. I watched all of them, most of them on television, but one of them actually in Faneuil Hall, and there was just such an aura of the past and that something, you know, quite important was happening. And, you know, these two men were like gladiators, you know, taking each other on in a very impressive way. And Kerry just rose to the occasion in a way that I think Bill Weld is still shaking his head over.
In fact, Bill Weld has said that Kerry was well-informed, quick on his feet. But he did wonder if the Kerry voice, you said echoes of the past. I know it was in the place that you were in, but others have said echoes of the Kennedy past as well. He has that Boston Brahmin voice, even though he's discovered recently that he has a Jewish background. But that aside, Weld and others wonder if his voice will carry outside of Massachusetts. Wayne, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I know that the Bush people wonder about that and think that's the kind of voice, frankly, however endearing that is to folks in Massachusetts and New England, it's the kind of voice that may, the Bush people believe, may turn people off around the rest of the country. People laugh at George Bush, at the Bushisms, at the malaprops, and so forth. But inside, I remember the 2000 race, and now talking recently to Bush people preparing for this debate, they're confident that their guy speaks English the way the majority of Americans like to hear it, direct, with clear, succinct, declarative sentences, sometimes twisted about, but more or less expressing a kind of directness and honesty and authenticity. They think that the Kerry language may score points in places that Kerry doesn't need to score points and may turn off voters in places who won't be so susceptible to an elitist, to someone from the Northeast.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk more about style in a moment, and style does matter in presidential debates. But, Joan, I want to ask you, tell us a little bit about the pugilistic nature of Kerry and those debates.
He came in ready to rumble, as they say. But looking back at them, I know you said we'll get to style, but let me jump a little bit to style here. I'm not so sure if that same style will resonate on the national stage. It was a very serious engagement between these two men. It wasn't lighthearted. There wasn't a lot of quipping. There wasn't a lot of, you know, humor. He scored a lot of points on issues like Weld was running on this platform of crime, welfare, and taxes, which would do well everywhere but in Massachusetts. John Kerry is playing to a liberal audience, tapping into that liberal wellspring that suddenly is wondering, do they really want a senator whose main platform is crime, welfare, and taxes? A major dramatic point of the debate was when Weld asked Kerry to defend his position against the death penalty. And Kerry said something to the effect of, I know something about killing. I don't like killing. I don't think a state honors life. by killing, sort of alluding to what had happened in Vietnam. It was a very, very dramatic moment that played very well in this state.
But you're speculating it might not...
Saying the issues don't necessarily cut the same way outside of Massachusetts as they do here in Massachusetts. He needs eloquence, and he certainly can be eloquent when he wants to be, but he may be having to defend some positions that will be harder to defend on the national stage.
You know, and Robin, the one thing about Bush that we really saw, and especially in that 1994 debate with Ann Richards, was really just the opposite. He was not particularly eloquent, but he was so extraordinarily disciplined at staying on message. Governor Bush or Governor Richards would ask him a question. He would say, that's a diversion. Let's talk about the stuff I want to talk about. I was on the panel. I asked a question. He answered it briefly and moved back to the issues that he wanted to talk about. Few things. So what we're going to hear in this Florida debate, of course, from the Bush campaign, is not only challenging John Kerry about whether he's a flip-flopper, have moved around, but also the Bush people want to reinforce a single theme, as we all know, steadfast leadership, I'm the guy who can protect you at home. And so look for George Bush to do exactly what he has always done beginning in 94, and that's to whatever the question is, whatever bit of rhetoric or drama is offered up or surprise here or there, to move back in a disciplined way to the positions that he wants to talk about, to the issues he wants to talk about, and the points that he wants to make.
Well, you know, we talked about John Kerry's voice, and Wayne, I just want to ask you before we go. It's been said that George Bush, the George Bush who debated Ann Richards in 1994, deliberately remade himself as someone that you might not think is super smart, as someone that you might think is just a regular guy, and that's been part of his appeal. But he's walking into a debate with an ongoing war, with criticism of the way he's assessed that war. Do you see him charming his way out of that? How do you see him approaching that?
Well, in the past, from time to time, he has made self-deprecating comments that try to show that he can be a likable guy. But I'm not sure this is the forum where that's going to play big. It is going to be, from the Bush point of view, an effort to present himself truly as a stable, strong commander-in-chief, and Kerry as anything but. So look for that. Less of this charming stuff, a few lines here or there, and more effort to present himself with, as I guess that cliched word, plenty of gravitas.
Could I just add the flip to that?
Yeah.
I think with Kerry, everyone knows he's smart. What they want to see is a little charm.
Right, which is a difficult position for him to be in when, you know, when the topic is war, this may not be the time for him to demonstrate he has a smile.
Right. How do you undermine the president in a likable way? It's a delicate line he has to walk.
Joan Vernocchi, columnist with the Boston Globe, who's covered Senator Kerry for quite a while. Wayne Slater with the Dallas Morning News. He's had his eye on George Bush for years. Thanks, both of you, for looking ahead to tonight's debates with us.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
And when we come back, can you watch tonight's debate with the sound off and still know who won? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. About a third of voters recently polled by news organizations say tonight's presidential debate and the two that will follow will have a great deal of influence on their vote. But will they be influenced by substance or style? Former Vice President Al Gore wrote in yesterday's New York Times that he hoped voters would be more influenced by policy than by which candidate would be more fun to have a beer with. But some say if that were to happen, it would be a first. Many Americans watch the debates to decide who they want coming into their living rooms for the next 4 years. We turn now to two debate veterans. Dick Werthlin made his name in politics as Ronald Reagan's chief strategist and pollster. He's the author of a book about Reagan called The Greatest Communicator. Welcome back, Dick.
It's good to be with you again.
And Martin Plisner, who as political director at CBS News has covered every presidential campaign since 1964. He's also author of the book The Control Room, How Television Calls the Shots in Presidential Elections. Martin, start with you. These rules for these debates are spelled out in an unprecedented 32-page memo negotiated by both campaigns. The candidates can't talk to or touch each other. They'll appear to be the same height at their respective podiums. Do you see anything in these rules that's really new or different?
First of all, you have to understand that most of this is boilerplate. The most important thing is that they've taken the town hall debate, which was supposed to introduce some spontaneity, bringing in real people to ask real questions. And instead of calling on them to ask questions, everyone has to submit his questions in advance in writing. The moderator is then supposed to go to it, select the questions, and then when he calls on people, they have to repeat the question exactly as it was written down, or they'll be cut off.
The town hall debate will be next week on October 8th, but tonight's debate will be a straightforward question and answer. What's the effect of these rules on all of the debates?
I think these rules are designed for one purpose, and that is to reduce not only the spontaneity, but reduce the risk that the two candidates are exposed to. And, of course, that leads to less spontaneity.
Right.
Which really takes a lot of the fire and the interest out of the debate. It's more like moving more toward set speeches given by each candidate, highlighting whatever messages they want, almost regardless of what the questions would be.
But as you both know, there have been those moments, the moment when Ronald Reagan says, "I paid for this microphone," I mean, when George Bush the first looked at his watch, that for some people have decided the issue.
I think that's exactly right. It's a little bit like flying. It's hours and hours of boredom, and then for the candidates and those who help them, seconds of raw terror.
Well, Martin, as you write, your book is subtitled "How Television Calls the Shots in Presidential Elections." Could you turn the sound off? I mean, is it literally, as some consultants, we were reading Bill Carrick this past weekend in the New York Times,
right,
in the style section, said that 75% of what a viewer thinks in these presidential debates is style. What about the idea that, you know, that there is this something to the gesture that Kerry needs to smile more, but Bush has to avoid looking too boyish? I mean, are the candidates thinking about these things?
Oh, sure.
I'm sure they think about them, but I don't know what they can do about them.
You have to be born with Ronald Reagan's smile.
That doesn't come naturally, for sure, Marty. But it is also very, very true that what the viewers are looking at are not only how they deal with the issues, but what it says about them personally. For example, the whole issue of security, I do believe, is one of the drivers of this campaign, and which candidate can project strength and consistency by both verbally and visually.
Linguistic professors have said that Kerry, for instance, has to be far more decisive, more declarative on issues like security, and more declarative in sentences rather than parenthetical sentences.
I think that's very, very true, especially among those who are soft supporters or undecided. So I think that's good counsel. Again, the question, however, is raised, can you coach a candidate to make more declarative statements? And my guess is you can in part. But the one interesting thing, even with all of the constraining rules and protocols that are developed, is that there still is somewhat a degree of spontaneity in the debate, and that's the thing that makes them both interesting and informative and a factor in the vote decision that can't be ignored.
Martin Plisner, again, a director at CBS News, for every presidential campaign from 1964 on, political director. What else does a candidate have to do within that frame of a television screen to communicate to the potential voter?
Well, I think the ability to argue his views well on issues should not be underplayed. I mean, that was really one of Bill Clinton's strengths. He could deliver 2 minutes with more nuance in it and more complicated sentence structures than anything you hear from Kerry. He could put it together.
Yeah.
I think this could be an election in which the candidate's performance in the debate could make a real difference. And I'm thinking mainly for Kerry. I've seldom seen a candidate at this stage of a campaign about whom people had so unclear an idea.
Yeah. And, Marty, isn't it also true that when an election is as close as this one appears to be, any small, influence and the debate can be not only small but moderate in its impact, has much greater influence than it would if the race were a runaway.
Yeah.
Martin Plissner, former CBS News political director, author of the book The Control Room, How Television Calls the Shots in Presidential Elections. Dick Werthlin, author of a book about Ronald Reagan called The Greatest Communicator. He was also Reagan's chief strategist and pollster. Thank you again, both.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the day after the debates, we'll try to separate fact from fiction. And we'll ask how the candidates do in those all-important swing states. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Cobb LaMarche is a genuine, honest, working-class ticket for the Green Party.
The fact is, he can't win.
I dare to dream that we can put libertarians in federal office.
Does this country belong to only two parties?
A segment of the new PBS documentary, Crashing the Parties 2004. The film follows the campaigns of four third-party candidates in their very serious quest for the White House. Joining us in the studio are two of the filmmakers, producer Darren Garnick. Hi, Darren.
Hello.
And director Peter Gozell. Thanks, Peter, for coming in.
Hello.
Your film focused on candidates from the Libertarian, Green, and Constitution parties, and of course Ralph Nader, who's running as an independent. You started with Gary Nolan. Now, he's a candidate for the Libertarian Party, which believes in limiting government. Nolan comes across as a bit rough around the edges. We have a scene here where he's taking questions from college students.
I'm just wondering, what action would the Libertarian Party take to end human rights abuses, such in countries like China?
We wouldn't. It's not our job to. If you feel compelled to, buy an airline ticket, grab a rifle, go to war.
Well, Director Peter Gozell, not the response that you'd get from the top-tier candidates. Go fly a kite, pretty much.
It sure isn't. That's what's great about following third parties is you just never know what they're going to say. They're going to tell you what they're thinking all the time. And it's very exciting, and that's one of the things that we enjoy, to following the candidates on the trail.
And your camera had to follow them very closely at points, Darren. I understand you were actually in cars with them. And
yes, we follow these candidates every region of the country except the Pacific Northwest on the year, a year on the trail with these third-party candidates. And Peter spent a week in a car with the Green nominee, David Cobb.
Whenever possible, I rent subcompacts, and if I can't get a subcompact, I get a compact like I've got now. And I carpool wherever possible. We're not going to be raising millions of dollars in this campaign, but we are going to be raising tens of thousands of dollars, maybe $100,000. And if I win the Green Party's nomination, I'm confident that we can raise probably about $250,000 or so.
That was David Cobb, the nominee of the Green Party, which focuses on social justice issues and the environment. And Peter, watching the film, you almost feel sorry for this guy. He's driving around the country, speaking his heart out. But the rooms are more or less empty.
They are. And the reason is for third parties, especially like the Green Party, they don't have the money to pay volunteers. And a lot of times when we showed up to some of these events, there was no publicity done to the event. So that's why there's maybe three people, five or 10 people in a room.
Right. You also followed Michael Perutka. He's of the Constitution Party. Many people may not have heard of this particular party. And in the film, as we'll hear, he lays out the party agenda.
The Constitution Party stands for really what the founders stood for, which is that there is a creator God and that our rights come from him. And the purpose of government, then, is to secure and protect and defend those God-given rights.
Darren, his party says they're running because they really think they're going to win.
Well, their political platform is religious-based, so they believe that God will help them win the nomination.
Right. The God is casting the vote for them.
Absolutely.
In effect. Well, of course, Ralph Nader is in the film, but more or less on the fringes. He's running as an independent candidate, not with any one party. And constantly in his campaign, he's dogged by questions of his effect on the past presidential election and the effect his candidacy could have on John Kerry's chances for the White House. Here's one of his responses.
They ought to concentrate on 8 million Democratic voters who voted for Bush in 2000, try to get him back. They're such whiners, carpers. That's the sign of a decadent party.
Peter, tell me, what was your sense of Ralph Nader? He seemed less, I mean, you've captured so much humanity in the other candidates. You didn't seem to get as close to him.
Anyone that's met Ralph Nader, he's not a guy that's going to suddenly show up in a Hawaiian shirt, start jumping around and joking around. Mm-hmm. He's a very straightforward business suit, carrying, you know, his briefcase guy. And I think we were able to capture that.
Yeah, you got
and we got some moments with them, too.
What there is. Darren, you also caught the sort of the essence of third-party candidates, the conventions. They really have them. Candidates are really nominated.
Yes, there's surprise endings to all the third-party conventions. You walk in and you don't know who the winner's going to be. It's very unusual. And just on another note, it's so much fun covering third parties. There's a zillion reporters covering Bush. There's a zillion covering Kerry. We almost have the third party beat to ourselves, and you'll never see people playing hacky sack on the convention floor of the Democrats and Republican conventions, and that's what we saw at the Green Convention.
We have some of the film on that as well. This is the Libertarian Convention. The frontrunner, Gary Nolan, does end up coming in third. Let's listen.
For Gary Nolan, 246. For Michael Badnarik, 256. For Aaron Russo, 258.
Well, I think the killer blow was last night at the debate. I couldn't speak. I was cutting all my sentences short. I couldn't make the impact that I should have.
Yeah, that was candidate Gary Nolan speaking to you after he was the front runner and he didn't get the votes he thought he'd get. Number three, Michael Badnarik went on to take the nomination there. We don't get that out of the two-party system. We don't get that sense of tension at a convention.
No, and what was interesting about the Libertarian Convention is that the guy with the least amount of money and the least amount of name recognition won. What happened was the two front runners, one was a Hollywood producer and the other one was a radio show star, their supporters hated each other's guts so much. The guy with no money but a powerful message just went right up the middle, and people in the room listened to what people were saying and voted just on the issues, and he won. It's a very emotional moment. Michael Badnarik's crying on stage with his mother. I think people will be really amazed to see this part of the film.
How powerful is this to people? I want to ask you about one other convention, because you also captured another moment that was talked about a little bit in the press but really was under the radar. Ralph Nader was not the Green Party, the official Green Party candidate. Many said the Green Party didn't want to be associated with him because he would tank some of their local candidates, and yet he did try to take the party nomination.
I think Ralph Nader wanted the support of the Green Party. He wanted their ballot lines, but he didn't want to be underneath the Green Party ticket.
At one point in the film, the Green Party candidate says, you know, some of us are kooks, some of us are visionaries. You spent a year with them. Darren, you first. What do you think they are?
What I took from that was everybody says third parties are a bunch of kooks. And from where I stand, there are plenty of kooks in the Republican Party, and there are plenty of kooks in the Democratic Party. Kooks and visionaries are across the political spectrum.
They're not saints, as you point out in the film, but are they patriots? What are they?
Third parties represent dissent in America. The way I see it is if their rights to run are crushed, my rights and your rights are crushed. These third parties need to be able to get on the ballot and get their voices out.
Mm. Darren Garnick was producer of the PBS documentary Crashing the Parties 2004. Peter Gozell was the director. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Their documentary, Crashing the Parties 2004, is now showing on PBS stations around the country. For more, log on to our website, here-now.org. Still to come, we visit a cafe in Amman, Jordan, for women only. You're listening to Here and Now. Have you heard? The Montreal Expos baseball team is moving to Washington, D.C., becoming the first baseball team in the capital since the Washington Senators left in 1971. Wait, I feel a song coming on.
We've got to think about the game.
The game, the game. We've got to think about the game. The game, the game.
The Washington Senators were central figures in the classic baseball story by Doug Wallop that became the hit musical and movie Damn Yankees. It tells of the Senators fan who sold his soul to beat the team in pinstripes, the Yankees. Well, we'll find out who sold what to get the Expos, but it's fair to say Washington's gain is Montreal's loss.
Being a supporter for over 30 years, it's a shame. We're losing the team. Montreal, province of Quebec, the big losers in this, and it's too bad.
Well, joining us in the studio now, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. And Bill, many are pointing out that it is too bad, but last night at their last game was the only sold-out game I think the Expos have ever had.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's amazing that they found that season ticket holder. There was one.
That's part of how this happens. Explain to us, first of all, how does this happen?
Well, that's the big part of how it happens, Robin. When people fail to buy tickets and fail to support a team, the people who own the team generally look for someplace else.
And how does Washington, D.C. pop up? The winner.
Well, that, of course, is a great question because previous editions of the Senators have moved to Texas and to Minnesota, so that the track record for supporting a baseball team in Washington, D.C. is not exactly sterling. But the reasoning now on the part of the people who want a team there is, number one, that there are more people in Washington than there used to be and in the surrounding D.C. area than there used to be. And number two, that the transportation is better than it used to be, so people won't have such a hard time going to the ballpark to see a game. So maybe they'll be right.
Well, the players, I mean, do they just get up and go to Washington? It's said that they're going to start playing in April.
Well, the team still exists as an entity that holds contracts. So, yes, Major League Baseball has been running the Expos since 2000. But everything is kind of up in the air because although we now theoretically know that the team is moving to Washington, we don't know yet who's going to own it. And this is a very bizarre sort of circumstance. We know where it's going to be, but we don't know who's going to run it. We don't know what color its uniforms will be because presumably the new owners will get to impose the favorite colors of their granddaughters on the team.
However,
I don't know how it's going to work, but much is still up in the air.
Well, let's find out a little bit more about how this is going to work. We're going to turn now to James Jones. He's a reporter for public radio WAMU in Washington, D.C. James, tell us about the financing behind this. Who's promised to pay what to whom?
Well, it's a given that you have to build a publicly financed stadium to get a baseball team. That's what Washington did. $440 million total in the package. They have to renovate RFK Stadium first for their first season. But the mayor of the city has come forward with a plan. Basically, anything that moves through the stadium will be taxed, and that's how they plan to pay for it.
Are people there excited?
Oh, absolutely. People are out of their heads, the people who are Senators fans. But there is strong opposition to building a stadium in Washington. And there are a lot of people that say Washington, D.C. has greater needs than baseball.
Right. Such as schools, for example.
Yeah, schools, maybe a public hospital that they have on the drawing board, potholes, even little things like that.
Right. And, of course, this argument that somehow businesses will pay the freight is based on the fact that once businesses are more heavily taxed, it will never occur to them to raise prices on their products, thereby sticking it to consumers as they generally do.
Oh, certainly. And the people who are really going to get to play with this toy called Major League Baseball team are going to be the people on the wealthier end of things when you look at how ticket prices are.
What are the chances, in your opinion, that the team does end up getting named the Washington Grays? Because that, to me, is pretty much the only redeeming factor.
We should say that Mayor Williams has said that he wanted to name it the Grays in honor of the old Negro League.
The Grays idea, I think, is going to get a lot of momentum. There's going to be a lot of pressure on the ownership team and on baseball to recognize the Grays. And, I mean, they were an absolute powerhouse team, so why not pick a name for a team of the winners that were in Washington?
Yeah, it also might be lucky because for a number of those years, the Grays drew better than the Senators.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Well, James Jones from WAMU in Washington, D.C., Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Here's what I have to say to both of you. You got to have heart. I want to thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
You got to have heart.
Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Some news we're following. Israeli troops and armored tanks pushed into a refugee camp in Gaza today, killing at least 21 Palestinians in the camp and elsewhere. Three Israelis were also killed in a separate incident. The raid comes a day after Hamas militants fired a rocket into an Israeli border town, killing two Israeli children. This month marks the beginning of the fifth year of the Intifada, the violent Palestinian uprising against Israel. Secretary of State Colin Powell yesterday called for an end to the Intifada. In an interview on Al Jazeera television, broadcast to the Arab world, Powell said, "The Intifada has spawned terrorism. What has it accomplished for the Palestinian people?" Powell also criticized Israel, saying President Bush has concerns about settlement activity. But when asked if Powell was blaming Palestinians and supporting an occupier, Powell reportedly bristled and said, "Who are the victims? The victims are those who are being blown up by bombs," an apparent reference to suicide bombers. And we're following this news as well. The pharmaceutical giant Merck says it is halting sales of its wildly popular drug Vioxx, saying a three-year study shows that the anti-inflammatory increases the risk of heart attack and stroke. Merck says it will reimburse patients for any tablets they have and that they should speak with their doctor about switching to another drug or treatment. About 2 million people worldwide take Vioxx. Many of them are arthritis sufferers. The Food and Drug Administration issued a warning today as well. Vioxx users should talk to their doctors and start considering an alternative. One of the most enduring images of life in parts of the Middle East is the veil that many women wear when they go out in public. For some, it's an imposition. For others, a badge of religious pride or a shield against unwanted advances from strange men. In all cases, home is where you take your veil off. But now, a new cafe in Amman, Jordan, offers women another place where they can go out for a night and still let their guard and their veils down. Freelance reporter Kristen Gillespie visited the Sabaya Cafe.
Most shops open for business by opening their doors. But at the entrance to the Sabaya Cafe, they roll down the curtains to keep out men's prying eyes. Sabaya is the first women-only cafe in Jordan, just about the only place outside of her home where a woman can laugh, sing, be extroverted, and if she wears one, take off her veil. Darlene is a student and works as a waitress at the Sabaya.
It's not that they don't feel that comfortable around men, but our traditions, they don't let them do that. They feel like they're like, I don't know the word, ishim raqabin.
Censored.
Censored, yes. They feel censored.
Yeah.
All the time.
But what do you mean by censored?
Every time they want to do anything, they just feel like all eyes are on them.
Nada, an Iraqi Christian, also works at the cafe. For her, whether you're veiled or not, Muslim or Christian, the accepted role for women is generally out of public view. Okay, I'm Christian, she says, but I'm still an Arab. Wearing a veil poses a dilemma for a woman. It can be a shield as well as a shackle. A stranger in the marketplace will think twice before harassing her with his words or his hands. And busybodies won't accuse her of loose morals. But Hanin Majali, the Sabaya Cafe's owner, says her clients need to get away from the glare of the public eye, but also, sometimes, from their own families.
Everything around them tells them that don't do this. You know, her father, while she's young, you must not dress like this. While she's small, you know, if your friend say a joke and you just laugh loudly, you know, I'm sure that they won't like it, you know. She laughs. They just said like this. So you have to act formally. When men's there, they are shy, they have to act formally. They are not themselves, you know.
As evening approaches, the staff prepares for a full house, lining up the coffee cups and heating the coals for the hubbly bubbly water pipes that are a favorite in Arab coffee houses. A female singer from Tunisia will perform at the cafe tonight. As the women begin to arrive, a girl in a heavy jacket and white headscarf sees me recording and comes over. Amal is still a teenager and, it turns out, a bit of a hothead.
Okay, why are you here?
Because I don't like men too much. I hate them.
Why?
Because they confuse me, especially when I want to do something free here. So they will look at me and I will be ashamed. So I want to be alone without men here.
You're taking off your veil right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why?
Because there's no men here.
And you're wearing a short sleeve shirt?
What?
Your shirt has short sleeves?
Yeah. Yeah.
But over it you have a jacket.
Yeah, because in our religion, it's in the veil you should cover your hands and your legs. Without your face.
Here's some pictures for the...
The singer Munia moves to the stage. Her backup band is a karaoke machine. Emil comes over in between sets. She is transformed. Her hair is styled, and she's wearing lip gloss and dangly earrings. She's going to sing, and she wants me to record it.
You will be here, the last?
I will, I'm staying.
Yeah, because I will sing a song here.
Emil takes the mic and sings fearlessly in front of this group of maybe 30 women. Maybe it's my Western bias, but I can't help feeling a pang of sadness. Teenage dreams of stardom are always remote, but for Emil, they are absolutely, positively beyond reach. This room is as far as she will go. Meanwhile, this is still the place to have fun and, for a little while at least, block out the outside world.
That's the nice feeling here. You don't think. You sit in any way you want. You know, you laugh in any way you want. If you want to say a joke, even loud, you know? You will say it, and the next table will laugh with you.
We just saw the pictures.
And about our kids, our life, everything.
And our adventure.
Yeah.
We still remember our days in biking, and how was it?
Reporter Kristen Gillespie visited the Sabaya Cafe in Amman, Jordan. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again here and now. For cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.